I want to tell you guys I love you and I appreciate your prayers and your goodwill. Sometimes we need to and have to go on and do as we purposed or we had purposed or as we had planned. Sometimes we find out that what we had purposed or had planned is also what is most needed. And I believe that that's where we are in our thinking about the Lord's Word right now. If I had known last week, last Sunday, what would happen before I saw you again, and if I could have chosen what I wanted to say to you, I would have chosen what I did then. I would have wished I could have said it better, but I would have chosen what I did then. And if I had known what it would be like to try to speak to you from Scripture today, and I could have chosen, I would have chosen this passage this morning. We set out and announced ahead of time that in December we're using the 8th messages to speak of what Christ is to His people. We think this is most appropriate for the closing of a year, but so much needed in the lives of the Lord's people. The book of Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews, is very much for Sunday mornings like this. It is written by someone who loved his readers so much and who was very open-eyed, realistic about the nature of life. No book in the New Testament is more that way than Hebrews is. And yet there is not a part of the New Testament that acts more to bring the message of Scripture to bear on the lives of people than this letter. It's like someone who loves his readers walks up and puts his arm around their shoulders and then urges them on with the strength that they need for what's before them in life. And it's if he tells them this is why this is worth doing and this is how it will be done. There are 8 phrases, 8 situations in this letter where almost in passing, the writer uses a description of Jesus to kind of call Christians' mind to what he means to us. It's interesting that these are most often phrases that are not used anywhere else in the Bible of the Lord. But they're so meaningful, and this one today, oh, how much it is. Hebrews 5 and verse 9 is where it occurs. The Word says, and I'll read 8 and 9, although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey Him. The source of eternal salvation. Think of that word. That word for source means to us that everything that we long for comes from Him and from His work and from what He's done for us. Notice that this is translated in the King James and some of the other versions with the word author, meaning that it comes from Him. What's a little confusing about that is that this is a different word from the one we read in chapter 2 and verse 10 last week, or the one which occurs in chapter 12 and verse 2, which is sometimes translated author. More recent versions use the word cause, that Christ is in his personal being and in his ministry, his work in our behalf is the cause of eternal salvation for us. I like to use the word basis. Who he is and what he has done is the basis of eternal salvation. We regard not what we've done or what we can do or what someone said or what someone else has done or what this one believes or that one believes, but Christ as the basis of eternal salvation, the cause, the source. I thought this week of what happened when I was a sophomore in college. And yes, I can remember that far back on my good days. When I was a sophomore in college, I had to take an English course, an English literature course, which turned out to be a whole semester of writing. I had no idea how much I would need that course over time. That's where I first learned that Ewan's isn't a word, and that ain't proper, and all kinds of important things like that. The professor in that course was a meticulous lady. I think she cared deeply about us, but she had weird ideas about things, and one of them was, it's not really weird, but for me at the time it was, one of them was, not one of you people in this room has an original idea, and 80% of your grade in this course is going to be from one thesis paper that you write, what we would call term paper. That it has to be, it sounded like 100 pages long, and it has to be researched, and it has to be on a writer in English literature. Mine turned out to be Robert Burns, and she assigned them to me, and I ended up with a guy whose big poem is To a Louse, if that tells you anything. And she would send us to the library, and at that point, there was not a digital one. You had to go. And she said, unless every paragraph in your paper is footnoted, you're not going to pass this course. And back then, they had work-study workers assigned to the professor, and she'd send them to the library with your paper and check out your footnotes. She wanted to know where the source of your thinking was. What are you basing this on? What makes you think you know what you're talking about? And you know what this writer is telling us is that for us as Christians, when anyone wants the basis or the source, or the cause of why we hope in this, or why we made that decision, or why we're trying to have a lifestyle like this, or where we're going to get the ability to survive what goes on in our lives, we footnote it. See Jesus Christ. And then everyone after that is Ibid, 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 Ibid. I don't know what that means, but I noticed that once a footnote says this, the rest of them just refer you back to it. Christ is the source to us. The source, though, of eternal salvation. Eternal means that this is something that's of a different quality, of a different realm, of a different kind. It doesn't just mean unending, although that's involved. That's one of the ways it's different. Salvation is a word that we ought to be more fascinated with. It's unfortunate that this term has just gotten turned into a religious word, because originally it was not. It was just a word for being rescued from any kind of threat or any kind of thing that had the capacity to destroy. It meant to be delivered from some terrible danger and given instead hope. In this book, the pictures of eternal salvation are priceless. There's a picture of children being led to glory, being brought to glory, chapter 2 and verse 10. And if you read the context, it's not just the glory of the Father's presence, but also the glory that we were meant to have before sin separated us from our real place in life. The glory of being remade into what we're meant to be. This book talks about the Sabbath rest for the people of God, inheriting the promises, a great reward, a better country, an abiding city, and things like that to talk about eternal salvation. To be rescued from what bad choices and wrong behavior and destructive words and actions do to people's lives. To be rescued from ignorance and darkness and alienation among people and within people. To be delivered from things that crush our hearts and fill our lives with grief. That's what Jesus is the source of, eternal salvation. He's the source of eternal salvation because he's been made perfect. That doesn't mean that he ever wasn't. It doesn't mean that he ever had a moral fault or a weakness or anything like that. It means, however, that God was willing to go to the trouble to qualify his own son unquestionably to do the work that he had in mind for and to make him completely fitted for the work that we needed him to do for us. If you back up in this chapter and thinking about this to verse 5, you notice the statement said of him, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." We immediately think of his birth, his becoming flesh, but that's not really the way the word is used. That phrase is used from Psalm chapter 2, verse 7. The New Testament applies this to the resurrection of Christ. In Acts 13 and verse 33 from the Apostle Paul, when he was raised up, the victor over death, as I told you last week, he came to be. When he had triumphed over the strong man, God raised him up and made him a king, the king we needed to rule with the rod of his mouth. If you look to the next verse or two down, verse 6, you notice it was said of him in another place, and this is Psalm 110 and verse 4, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." That is, you have an unending priesthood. Most of us are not that familiar with the concept of the work of a priest, but think of a priest as a bridge builder. When sin enters human experience, we experience distance from God. Not only an unlikeness to Him, but also a dread of Him, and maybe over time a loss of any respect for Him or any knowledge of Him. So the priest is God's idea. He gives a priest so that a representative of man will be able to come into his presence and to plead the cause of man with an understanding heart because he's one of them. And that's a great part of the message of Hebrews, maybe the main one, that Christ does this for us, that he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for him. Chapter 7 and verse 25. And that he now lives to appear before the face of God for us, as chapter 9 of this book will say. We have a king who is morally qualified to rule, and the priest who experience-wise is sympathetically qualified to serve. And the reason is that he's raised up and he's appointed after, in the days of his flesh, he has learned obedience through what he suffered. It doesn't mean that he ever was disobedient. One older writer explained, this is the difference between innocence and virtue or courage. Innocence is unstained, but virtue is tested. Jesus, in the days of his flesh, was tested like no one has ever been. In verse 7, it says that he offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. Almost all of us can recognize that the time when that was most apparent was in the Garden of Gethsemane, right when he knew that he was about to bear the sins of the world, and right before he was arrested, and right when hell would have been putting the pressure on him not to do it. Remember, he prays in agony. He cries out, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But then there's his godly fear. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. The strange thing about verse 7 is it says he was heard because of his reverence. And you and I think, wait, we just been here this morning remembering that there wasn't another way in the Father's will to do this, and that he died for us. Well, if you look back at these accounts, at Luke 23, at verses 42 and 43, Jesus said, Father, this is Gethsemane now, Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. Being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. His sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And then he rose from prayer and came to his disciples. And he did what God sent him to do. Being heard by a father doesn't mean release from responsibility. It means strength to do it. It's meant that ever since Jesus, and it means it now. The source of eternal salvation, being made perfect by having learned obedience. So we're not surprised, or we shouldn't be, when it says he's the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. And obey is in the present tense, who are obeying him. In Hebrews, the word obey is often a substitute for faith. There is no conception in this book that one can exist without the other. What happens is that he, by grace, tastes of death for every person, but that not every person possesses eternal salvation unless their hearts are changed enough that they're willing to depend on his having tasted of death for every man. And hence there is the statement in this passage about to all those who obey him. How else could we be of the same family as him? If even though he was a son, he learned obedience, how else could we be of that family without the intention to obey him? We don't always have the same ability that he proved to have, but the intention. He saves us from something, and he saves us for something, from dead works to serve a living God. But he doesn't save us in what we had to be rescued from. He doesn't sail by on the boat and say, I know you're drowning, but I'm here as the source of salvation. You go ahead and drown, and I'll save. No. He comes to rescue and to put right, or to transform. And don't forget, friends, he remains the source whose work is the ground of our hope, even as we are obeying him. If I seek to obey him, the accent still needs to be placed on him being the source of my salvation. I hear us, and I struggle with this too. We think, all right, I want to obey the Lord. Have I done enough? I don't think I've done enough. I don't know if I've obeyed him enough. Is he the source, or is our obedience the source? Put that way, you see that there's an answer to that question. Of course we haven't done enough. That never was the source. The point is whether we want to have the same attitude Jesus has about it. He became the source of eternal salvation after being made perfect to all who obey him, despite the two threats which appear in Hebrews here on either side of this text. One threat is the heart hardened by the deceitfulness of sin, chapter 3, verses 12 through 15. I just refer us to that. The experiences of life can either tenderize our hearts or harden them. Sin can make us bitter, selfish, stubborn, or unthinking. Being called to the source of eternal salvation helps us to avoid that insensitivity. On the other end of this, there is the indifferent heart that is dull of hearing, the problem of apathy. Not hardened, but apathy, where we don't care anymore. I suggest, my brothers and sisters, we can't care right now. We are goners. If we can't not be apathetic about that which matters most, but if we care, let's turn our minds not back to what happened or how we feel about it, but to the source of eternal salvation. And if we do that this morning, then what I've tried to say will have accomplished its purpose. He, being made perfect, became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. If I just said that all of us here who have something on our hearts we need to lay before the Lord come this morning, then every one of us would. So let me say, if you've been made aware of the need to have a source for how you think and act that will serve the tests of life and of all time, and if you've become convinced that Jesus is that one and want to confess His name and to be baptized into Him, please let us know that this morning. If you're someone who's drifted away and you realize what could happen and you can see the need to make sure you've drawn close to the Lord, then this morning while we stand, then come, let's deal with that in the Lord's way. If you need to, come while we stand and sing together.